Average risk is 12% if you live to be 95. Relative risk means what is my risk compared to average? And that can be how many times the average risk or what percent increase over that risk. And that can be a little trickier. So I gave an example. If your mother had breast cancer at age 60 and nobody else in the family had breast cancer, that is a 1.1 to 2 times average risk. Doesn't sound so bad, but it's almost twice the average risk. Or it's talked about in terms of a 30% increased risk. That sounds bad. Do I have a 30% chance of getting breast cancer? No. It's 30% over average, which means you take 12%. 30% of 12% is 4%. You add that together, get 16%, and that's the absolute risk. Unfortunately, there is no mathematical model which takes into account all the different risk factors, puts it into the computer, and spits out what your absolute risk is. Even I have a hard time sometimes reading the literature and trying to figure out what does this really translate into a person's absolute risk. So keep that in mind when you're reading and hearing about things and try to say, okay, what does it really mean for me? The risk for breast cancer goes up with age. The longer we have these things around, the more likely they are to get us into trouble. So I did put a little table in here from the American Cancer Society that tries, again, put it in perspective. If you are 30 and you haven't had breast cancer, your risk for getting breast cancer in the next 10 years is 0.5%. That's not very much. If you're 70, your risk for getting breast cancer, and you haven't had breast cancer yet, your risk for getting breast cancer in the next 10 years is just under 4%. So even though this is an important subject, even though we all have to be aware of it and there's things we can do about it, it's maybe not quite as scary as it seems like in the media. And remember that the risk of getting breast cancer is not the same as the risk of dying of breast cancer. Most women get treated and do fine. So the risk for dying of breast cancer is much less. Nonetheless, if you don't get breast cancer, you also don't have to have surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy. So it's good in and of itself to not get breast cancer. I did put some resources here at the end of the first page if you want to go on the internet and find out more about this subject. The last one is a comprehensive 250-page treatise about risk for breast cancer, so you probably don't want to go through all that, but it's there for you if you want. I'll talk about the Gail model in a minute. I just listed a lot of the risk factors that we know about and tried to put behind it what I think is a small increased risk, a moderate increased risk, or a high risk. And I put into categories. Well, the main risk for having breast cancer is being a woman. Men rarely get it. They do get it, especially if there's a family history, but it's mostly a woman's disease. Age, as I said, makes a big difference. So if you're over 65, your risk is much higher than if you're 45. A personal history of breast cancer. There's probably a lot of factors that went into it, so I didn't really, of making that breast cancer to begin with, so I didn't really categorize that. But something about that woman's body allowed breast cancer the first time, so she has a higher rate of getting breast cancer a second time than somebody else does the first time. Genetics. Dr. Hoberman has given a whole lecture on genetics, so I won't go to it too much. But there's several genes that we know about which, if abnormal, predispose to breast cancer, if they are inherited. There's a lot of talk about genetics and cancer, and there's two separate categories. One is genes that you have inherited, which, if abnormal, are abnormal in every cell in your body. Every breast cell is abnormal and therefore predisposed to getting breast cancer. The other genetics is, okay, there's a breast cell there that went bad. What genes in that breast cell went bad and how can we treat those genes? So that's the treatment part of genetics. So when you hear about genetics, there's two different things that we're talking about. So what we're talking about here is genes that you could have inherited. The most important genes are BRCA1 and 2. They stand for breast cancer 1 and 2. And if you have inherited an abnormal gene, you have somewhere between 45 and 85% chance of getting breast cancer in your lifetime, and that is what Angelina Jolie has. And that is one of the highest risk factors for breast cancer, knowing that you have inherited one of those BRCA1 or 2 genes, which is abnormal. The rest of these are family histories that go along with those genes. The 2 genes predispose to breast, mostly breast and ovarian cancer. So if you have a lot of women in your family with breast cancer, especially if there's ovarian cancer, especially if there's male breast cancer, if the breast cancer occurs at young age or both breasts, those are all clues that maybe there is a gene in your family that's running around that you could have inherited. So when share with your doctor your family history of breast and ovarian cancer to see whether or not you're a candidate for testing, because there are tests that can be done. They're simple blood tests, or you can spit into a tube and they take the DNA from the cheek cells. Being of Ashkenazi Jewish heritage is important because there are 3 BRCA gene abnormalities. They're big, long genes. You can get abnormalities anywhere along there that are prevalent in the Ashkenazi Jewish or Eastern European Jewish population. So just being Ashkenazi Jewish gives you a moderate risk for breast cancer. There are other genes that can also predispose to breast cancer. I listed some of them here. Cowden's, Lee, Frommini, Lynch, Poitz-Jaegers. They have a different cluster of cancers, not breast and ovarian, but breast, thyroid, and uterine, or breast and colon. So if your family has a bunch of cancers and in one side of the family, because if you have a breast on your dad's sister and your mom's sister, that doesn't count. It has to be all in the same family so they can come down in the same heritage. Talk to your doctor about it. Then there's a whole class of hormonal factors. Probably it's hormones that really make the difference, because as I said, men rarely get breast cancer. They have breast tissue. Their breasts don't develop. And it's our hormones that develop our breasts, so probably the big underlying cause is our hormones, but we don't understand it well enough. Hormonal factors that we know make a difference is if you start your periods early. Sort of think of the longer you have uninterrupted periods. So if you start early, start before 12, if you stop after 55, if you don't breastfeed because you tend to have more, we're not sure what breastfeeding makes a difference. It seems to make a very small difference. If you have your first child after age 30 or don't have any children at all. If you take replacement hormone therapy after menopause, if it's combination estrogen and progesterone. If it's estrogen alone, surprisingly, that does not increase the risk. It's surprising to everybody who works with breast cancer because there's other high estrogen things that predispose, but estrogen only does not. If you're on replacement hormones, you need progesterone to protect the uterus. So you're sort of stuck. And it's not a high risk, but it is a risk factor. As a matter of fact, I mentioned that in 2004, a study came out showing that women on replacement hormones combination have a higher risk for breast cancer and a higher risk for heart attacks. We had thought that if there's a lower risk for heart attacks, but there's actually a higher risk. Once that was published, and many doctors talk to their patients and about maybe you shouldn't be on this, and the incidence or the rate at which women got breast cancer in the United States actually went down, only for postmenopausal women. So the best explanation we have is that women got off their replacement hormones and avoided having breast cancer, some of them. Some women simply cannot handle life without in menopause. It's very different for everybody, and it's not like you're giving yourself a death sentence if you're on replacement hormones. But if you can get off them, get off them. Obesity or weight gain after menopause. Obesity in general, and especially weight gain after menopause, we're not sure what the difference makes, but it does increase the risk for breast cancer. There are precursor hormones made by our adrenal glands after menopause that get changed to estrogen and body fat. So the more body fat you have, the higher the levels of estrogen you have. So that is one of the thinking behind why that is true. But it's hard to not gain weight after menopause, hard to keep it off, but it's much better for you. DES exposure in utero, this has gone back and forth over the years, and DES isn't used much anymore. That was, that was before. That was my parents' generation, I think, that used that. And starting birth control pills, especially if it starts at a young age, taking birth control pills longer than 10 years, especially if starting at a young age. However, most of those studies are older and used higher dose birth control pills, so whether or not that's true now, it actually decreases the risk for ovarian cancer, and you certainly don't want unwanted pregnancies. So everything we do in life has a balance. Then there's a category that I call metabolically active breast tissue. Breast tissue is active. It does things. It's physiologically doing things. And after menopause, usually that activity goes down. The breast tissue shrinks up, but gets replaced by fat. Sometimes that continues. In younger women, you can have more or less active breast tissue. Sometimes after having a child and after breastfeeding, it'll sort of shrink away, but it's shown in several ways. One is a breast density on mammography. So if a breast is dense, it's trying to look through a window. And if you have fatty breasts, you can look right through the window to see what's behind it. If you have dense breasts, it's like looking through that curtain to see what's behind it. It's harder to read the mammograms, and it means that the breast tissue is just, it's all active and robust there. I put down as a moderate risk, but it depends on what the breast density is. There's four categories of breast density. Yes?
How do you know if you have dense breast tissue?
You have a mammogram.
Okay.
And it should be on the mammogram report. There is a proposal in Michigan that every woman who has a mammogram has to be informed of her breast density. And that's good and bad. Because, yes, it means that you have an increased risk for breast cancer, but most women won't understand what that risk is, how high a risk it is, and what to do about it. So it would make more sense to... And then, do you inform them about the high risk if they started their periods early? And do you inform... I mean, look at this list. And so picking out one... You know, I have mixed feelings about this. Yes, we should inform women about a lot of things. And I'm afraid that it will go, oh, my God, I'm going to have breast cancer, and what do I do, and let me see the surgeon. And so it's got to be done carefully. There are several states who have passed that law already. And it's hard because you're looking at something, and Dr. Irvine is talking about that, and without actual pictures, you can't really see what it's showing. But it's somewhat subjective. So for the highest dense breast tissue, we say they're whited out. We can't see a thing. That really is an significant increased risk. The moderately dense breast tissue, well, maybe small to medium risk. So it's something to think about, but not to hang your hat on. Having a benign breast biopsy, I don't think that the actual needle going into the breast causes breast cancer. It's that women with active breast tissue are going to have more calcifications, more nodules, more cysts, all this stuff that cause us to do a biopsy. So women who have a benign breast biopsy have a higher risk, probably because of their basic underlying breast activity. Now, one thing that's very important is if you have a breast biopsy that is not cancer, but which shows atypical cells, that really means there's something going on. It's like I tell patients, okay, if you're light-complected, you're more likely to get sunburned than if you're dark-complected. If you have atypical cells, atypical ductal hyperplasia, atypical lobular hyperplasia, or lobular carcinoma in situ, you got the kind of breast tissue that kind of likes to make breast cancer. So it's not a precancer, it's just a condition that, okay, you got that kind of breast, and it's a significant increased risk. Environmental, I put down radiation therapy to the chest. This is for women who've had lymphoma or Hodgkin's disease and need to irradiate the lymph nodes under the breastbone. There's some scatter. In the old days, young women who had TB and got multiple chest x-rays and moving picture x-rays, which are significantly higher, radiation also got increased risk for breast cancer. There's usually a lag of about 15 to 20 years. Alcohol consumption, the more you drink, the risk goes up. It's not a high risk, but the more you drink, the risk goes up. Smoking has been back and forth. There probably is a small association, but there's a much higher association with lung cancer. And more women die of lung cancer than die of breast cancer. It's only half as common. We don't talk about it because there's more factors that we can control about it, but it's not found as quickly, and we don't have as good treatments. We got lots of good treatments for breast cancer.
If I went slow, we're like 30 miles from the nuclear power plant.
We have, in fact, you can look at that that 250-page one that I put in there. There's been a whole bunch of environmental things looked at. Probably the most recent one is the plastics that's found in water bottles, et cetera, that gets off. And it lines vegetable cans, and it's everywhere, especially if it's microwaved. I personally tried to avoid plastic, but you can't. You can't buy food that's not in plastic. So there have been a lot of things that have been looked at. There's nothing that's coming out as being a big, the big onerous thing yet. Doesn't mean there isn't stuff in our environment that it may be contributed to causing breast cancer. The radiation, you have to have a radiation leak for that. We know that women, as I said, who survived the atomic bomb, that's a lot of radiation. We get radiation every time we get a mammogram. And that's why we don't do it in youngest women, because they're at low risk for breast cancer. They're less likely to see things because they have dense breasts. And we start at age 40. Younger tissue is more sensitive to radiation than older tissue. So everything we do is a risk-benefit, trying to get it just right. So to answer your question, there have been no, there's a big cluster in Long Island. Big cluster of breast cancer. Everybody's trying to figure out what that is. Well, there's a big Jewish population in Long Island. Maybe that's it. Breast cancer risk goes up with the GDP of a country. The more richer you are, the more breast cancer you have. Well, I don't think it's handling money that does that. It probably has to do with diet and starting periods earlier because you're better nourished, and maybe it's the animal fat. It's, who knows what. So right now I'm not worried about living here. I might be worried if I was in Japan. But there's been no evidence that I've ever heard of. Dr. DeCook is one of my partners, so that's why I keep looking to him for confirmation that shows anything in Japan. So it's a good question, but right now there's no big environmental things that have been shown. So what do we do if you have an increased risk? What do you do about it? Well, there's three levels of things you can do. Something we should all do, some things that are reserved for women with moderate risk, and some things that are reserved for women with the highest risk. The things we should all do is lifestyle changes, and the most important is exercise. Regular exercise, aerobic exercise, try to get around 4 hours a week, can decrease your risk for breast cancer by 10 to 20%. And that's significant. That's a lot. I mean, it's a commitment. That's 4 hours a week is a commitment. But you deserve it. You can take some time for yourself. There's a lot of different reasons why that might work. It might work through insulin metabolism. It might work through body fat, through inflammation. But it does work.
Yeah.
Stress relief, yeah. attain an ideal body weight, especially if you're past menopause. Again, weight gain after menopause increases risk. And you know what? Eat right and exercise. If we'd all do that, we'd all be healthy. It's so simple and so difficult. What about stop combination hormone replacement if you can, if you're on it. Diet. The only thing that we know enough about is to limit alcohol consumption. The rest of these things have a lot of both some laboratory evidence and some sociological evidence that it might help, but we're not there yet. And if you haven't been to Dr. Cacarella's talk, she's talking on nutrition. She probably told you a lot more about that. So there's antioxidants found in green tea that may be helpful. If you drink green tea, boil the water, let it cool down for 5 minutes, and then make the tea. It takes that bitterness out. Much more palatable. And that's the way it's supposed to be made. I don't drink coffee, so I know about tea. Yeah, and who knows how much is out. The laboratory stuff uses some really high doses of the antioxidants found, and the studies have been done in China in women who drink green tea versus black tea versus no tea at all. The women with green tea get the least breast cancer, but it's very variable how much they eat or how much they drink. So, but if Dr. Cacarella said it, I go with it. diet low in animal fats, again, question is that they're really the animal fats, or people with the high fat diets are heavier and that's what it is. But it's probably good to not have high fats. Diet high in fresh fruits and vegetables, again with the antioxidants. I think Dr. Cockerella talked about turmeric. This is the spice that's found in curry. There's a lot of laboratory evidence recently to suggest this might have a beneficial effect about breast cancer. She's doing research on it, so listen to her podcast. Vitamin D levels, half the evidence says yes, low vitamin D is associated with breast cancer. The other half says no, it's not. We don't know yet. We live in Michigan. We don't see the sun. We have low vitamin D levels. It makes sense that if you're at risk for breast cancer, maybe you should get your vitamin D level checked, and if it's low, to take some supplements. But insurance doesn't always pay for that test, but unless you already have osteoporosis. So along with that, you should watch yourself. We try to diagnose breast cancer early. Check your own breast once a month. The U.S. Task Force came out and said, no, don't check your breast every month because you might get worried. Well, I think we can handle some work. So it's difficult because breasts are lumpy, but you get to know what your breasts are like. If something changes, you notice it. They also said, well, the doctors don't have to check your breast every year either. And you know, all of us who've taken breast cancer, we see the tumors that are this big instead of this big because somebody felt it. So I think you should have
it's
a...
free.
Yeah, right. Exactly. I do follow the American Cancer Society recommendations for mammograms, yearly starting at 40. The question is when to stop them, because if you find breast cancer early, you're finding it 10, 15, 20 years before it would cause somebody's death. So if you're 80, do you really need a mammogram? I think that avoiding surgery, radiation, and chemotherapy is also worth it. So I don't have an age limit on when to stop getting mammograms. If you have a high risk or family history, we sometimes move that up to 5 years before the youngest person in the family who had breast cancer. Then there's some things that are under investigation, and one is a mammogram with tomosynthesis, and that's sort of like taking a CAT scan of the breast, so that if you have very dense breasts and everything is getting in the way, you can take, it's like little slices through the breast, and you can more easily find lumps. In the studies that have been done so far, there's not a lot of them, not only did it find more cancers, but it seemed to reduce the number of biopsies. So they could see something better and better characterize it and not have to do the biopsy and call back.
And where is that available now? Because it's relatively new.
Spectrum. And I don't know. We are looking at a machine right now.
It's
so we'll be doing something.
Is it a mammography machine?
You don't know the difference. Yeah, you don't know the difference. You still get squeezed.
Right, yeah.
But they had the images that moves like
right.
A tomogram.
Yes.
It's
okay.
A cheap kind of CAT scan technology,
yeah.
Going as far as right. MRI or some others.
So the question is, who should it be used for? It's a little higher dose of radiation than mammography. There should, in the next few years, it should be down to the regular dose. So right now, I use it for women at increased risk who have dense breasts. Maybe someday it'll be attached to every mammogram. But it's not. It's not everybody around the country is getting on the bandwagon yet. It's out there. Whole breast ultrasound is also out there. In fact, there's automated whole breast ultrasounds where you go under a machine, it just sort of ultrasounds your whole breast, and it can find more cancers. The problem with it is it also finds more benign things that we can't categorize, and you end up getting more biopsies. So still finding the balance, not doing too much, not doing too little. The story's out on it yet. Breast MRI is very sensitive at finding breast cancers, but is too sensitive because it picks up all kinds of things that are wrong with your breasts. And you end up getting a lot of breast biopsies and a lot of callbacks. It's been shown that it would help save lives in women with BRCA mutations. So if you have inherited a BRCA mutation, or if you come from a family that has a significant family history suggesting that, then the American Cancer Society recommends that. And there are different models that we can put you into and get a number out of. The American Cancer Society recommends that you get a yearly MRI. Yearly screening MRIs for everybody else, there's not data behind. Maybe it's good, maybe it's not. It tends to be individualized. It tends to be not very consistent across physicians, and that's because we don't have enough information on it yet. Okay, the next big thing, so that close follow-up and lifestyle changes. Everybody should do the close follow-up, depends on what your risk is. Preventative drugs are not for everybody. The drugs are tamoxifen, raloxifen, and exemestane. Tamoxifen is an anti-estrogen drug that's been used for a long time to treat breast cancer. In the early studies, it was shown that not only did women live longer because it cured some of them, they also got fewer new breast cancers in the opposite breast, suggesting it also prevents it. Or it kills it off before we ever found it. Either way, that's a good thing. Several studies were then done using women with an increased risk and giving tamoxifen or a sugar pill. And the studies have shown that taking tamoxifen for 5 years cuts the risk in half. It's very significant. It comes at a price. There are some problems with, especially with hot flashes, with increased blood clots, and increased uterine cancer. The increased uterine cancer is a very low rate, but it's there. So you don't, that's why we don't put it in the water. It's extremely effective and very helpful for women at a certain level of risk. The other drugs, and that can be used premenopausally or postmenopausally. Raloxifen is also known as Evista. It looks chemically a lot like tamoxifen, which is, tamoxifen and raloxifen are competitive inhibitors, if you remember your high school chemistry. It attaches where estrogen would and then doesn't let estrogen get to it, get to that cell and interact with the cell. But sometimes it acts just like estrogen. So it has both estrogen activity and anti-estrogen activities. Raloxifen was tried in breast cancer, didn't seem to work for treating breast cancer, but it seemed to help osteoporosis. So does tamoxifen, just like estrogen does. So then it got taken down all the osteoporosis studies, was approved for osteoporosis. In the osteoporosis studies, it said, ooh, this looks like it prevents breast cancer. So then there was a study done with tamoxifen and raloxifen with increased women with increased risk for breast cancer. The early studies suggest that they are very similar. With time goes on, probably tamoxifen is a little better. But raloxifen has fewer side effects, less likelihood to cause uterine cancer or blood clots. So if you're at risk and you're postmenopausal, we've got to juggle what's best. Recently, there's the exemestane, also known as aromacin, has not been approved yet for prevention, but there has been a study that looked at this. This is a drug that is also used for treating breast cancer. It's for postmenopausal women. After menopause, the adrenal glands still, as I mentioned, produce these pre-estrogen hormones that then get changed to estrogen and fat. The aromacin just stops that chemical reaction, so it stops all the estrogen in your body. And that actually was seemed to be more effective, maybe up to 70% reduction in risk than the tamoxifen or the raloxifen. The FDA hasn't approved it for that yet, but it can be used off-label with a discussion with the patient about, and it doesn't not have the increased risk for blood clots or uterine cancer. It tends to give some arthritis-type symptoms. So again, this is reserved for the women at moderate to high risk for breast cancer.
Does it affect your heart?
Not that I have seen, no. I have not heard of anything cardiac. So what about surgery? What about Angelina Jolie? Removing the breast tissue, which is called bilateral prophylactic or preventative mastectomies, can reduce the risk for breast cancer by 90%. It's not 100% because the breast isn't, as I say, it's not just a hard-boiled egg sitting on your chest. Somebody dropped that egg, and you're trying to get all the bits of egg up. So there is a little bit of breast tissue that gets left. But reducing it by 90% is very significant. If Angelina Jolie was looking at a 40 to 85% chance of getting breast cancer, it's gone to 4 to 8%, which is significant. It comes at a price. It's reserved for the women at highest risk, and it's an individual choice. In my practice, I'd say about half the women who are it would be appropriate choice for choose that, and the other half choose close follow-up. The mastectomies can be done in such a way that they're very cosmetic. There are pros and cons to saving the nipple. For most surgeons, it's a discussion with the patient. There's a little bit of breast tissue that's left, but it's minimal. And recent studies have shown that it's very unlikely to get breast cancer in the nipple after this procedure. So we can talk about saving the nipple. Reconstruction is done several different ways. Usually the surgeon removes the breast tissue and the plastic surgeon puts something in its place. There's several different ways of doing the reconstruction. So there's lots of choices. There is no sensation afterwards to the skin or the nipple. But when you step out of the shower, still look a lot like what you used to look like. So again, that's an extremely individualized decision-making process, and nobody ever puts a gun to somebody's head and say, you gotta do this. It's most appropriate for women who have an abnormal gene and already have breast cancer and are already looking at mastectomy for one of their choices. It's probably next most appropriate for women with an abnormal BRCA1 or 2 gene. There are other women who have a lot of risk factors who just feel most comfortable doing that, and that's fine. It's an individual decision as long as somebody has all the information upon which to make those decisions. Finally, for women who have inherited an abnormal BRCA1 or 2 gene, they are also at risk, increased risk for ovarian cancer. It usually occurs at an older age, 50s, 60s, and we usually recommend they have their ovaries out after they're done having children. It reduces the risk for ovarian cancer, not 100%, but by a great deal. And if you have your ovaries out before menopause, it cuts your risk for breast cancer. If you have them out before 35, it cuts your risk for breast cancer in half. So some women will say, well, take my ovaries and I'll deal with my breast later because I've already decreased my risk. But that's true even if you're put on replacement hormones. Doesn't make sense. You think, well, geez, if I put on replacement hormones then I've just increased my risk, but that's one time where replacement hormones seems to be okay as long as you stop them when you hit menopause age. Okay, I talked faster this time. More time for questions. Anybody have any questions about this? Yes.
How do you know if you have the BR?
See it.
Yeah. If there hasn't been any breast cancer in your family, but if it could just arise, yes, no.
It almost these genes almost never arise de novo. There are some that do. This Li-Fraumeni syndrome is a P53 gene, and that can just start an individual. But the BRCA genes are very big, long, complicated genes, and apparently very stable because they're just not abnormal that often.
And the only way to find out is genetic testing.
Yes, but the only reason to get genetic testing is if you have a family history, a significant family history. Because again, one out of 12 American women, who doesn't have somebody in their family with breast cancer? You know, it's got to be a significant family history.
Jane, what's it cost to do and when insurance pays for it?
Well, it's about $3,500. It used to be $3,500 plus $700 for an additional test. Myriad Labs had put a patent on this gene, and they were allowed to have a patent. It didn't make sense. I mean, can I patent an elm tree or whatever? So it was particularly disturbing in the academic community who were working on genetics, and they took them to the Supreme Court, and Myriad Genetics lost. So now there are other labs that are offering the tests, and I expect that the cost will come down. There's all kinds of issues about genetic testing. You know, can I get life insurance? Can I get health insurance if they know about this? What do I tell my sisters? What do I tell my cousin who doesn't want to know about it? Before somebody gets tested, all that kind of stuff has to be discussed, because I've tested people who, it turns out, their parents aren't the parents. The person was adopted because neither of the parents had this gene. I mean, you know, and then there's the privacy. It can get very, very complicated. Yeah.
I live outside of this community. There's a gal that I know that she went through the genetic testing, and she said if you have the genetic testing, you've gone through it, her daughter can go get the genetic testing at a lesser cost.
Correct. There's two, the BRCA genes are very long genes, and it's like instructions. Okay, it's like a sentence giving an instruction to make a tumor suppressor protein. So if the sentence is gobbledygook, you're not going to make that tumor suppressor protein. You're not going to suppress tumors of the breast and ovary. And some abnormalities along there doesn't matter. So if the big red dog chased a cat, what if you're missing the? And you read big dog, red dog chased a cat. You get the gist. It probably doesn't matter. So that's a mutation that doesn't matter. What if the T is off and then everything gets shifted over one? Well, then none of the words make any sense. And that is a deleterious mutation. So sometimes it's just one nucleotide. Sometimes it's a bunch of them. Sometimes it's a section. Sometimes they're rearranged. But once in the family we know what the abnormality, which gene, which abnormality, then everybody in the family just needs to be tested for that abnormality, because to have two abnormalities in the same family just doesn't happen. So, and that is about $350 to $450 test. Many insurances are covering this. It's much, much better covered than it used to be. There's a law passed by Congress 8-10 years ago called the GINA law, genetic information something, and it prevents group insurances from not providing insurance to somebody who has a genetic abnormality. It does not cover private insurances. I don't understand the new healthcare act, but apparently there are supposed to be some more things in there to help prevent that. There has not been a documented case of somebody being prevented from having healthcare insurance. Nobody, you look at the genetic community, nobody has ever heard of a case where somebody could not get health insurance. But there have been some people who couldn't get life insurance. So sometimes somebody's going to get tested, and they say, think about whether you want to buy life insurance before you get tested. It gets, as I said, pretty complicated. Any other questions? Well, then we get out early and we get first to the food. The food is in the big tent along with gifts and some drinks, and so time to have fun.